1 Timothy 4:15, practice these things, immerse yourself in them so that all may see your progress. All right, so that's what this class is about. And you always have to keep that forefront of your mind because preaching is one of those things that we improve with practice and with experience. So week one, we thought about that critical need to stay on the line. So this is the deep conviction that the text is king. We're not king, right? We don't stand over the text. Rather, the text stands over us, right? The text rules us. And therefore, we want to stay on the line. And we want to say no more or no less than what God's word has said. And of course, how do we do that? Well, we want to follow the proper pathway of preparation. And that's what we thought about last week. And so I think I can do this. Yeah, we thought about this last week. Does this look familiar? All right, so we've got a text. We've got our first audience. And we've got the cross. And then we've got today. And we think, oh yeah, we want to run just right to today. But we said the safest way home is the longest way around. So we want to move from the text and we need to do some exegesis. We'll think more about that today to the first audience. Then we have to do some theological reflection, right? As we get to Christ. So it'll be fun this morning in John 18 when I'm preaching. Be looking for that. There's a lot of that going on as we go through Christ. And then we do some persuasion and we get down to today. All right. So that's sort of that pathway to prep. And now what we're going to do is we're going to actually start to break down some of these steps. So some of these here are convictions. Now we're going to get to some of the tools. Okay, what are these tools of exegesis that help us get from the text to the first audience? Okay, so that's what we're going to be thinking about, particularly with structure this morning. And so with that in mind, I wonder how many of you, any of you enjoy jigsaw puzzles? Okay, a few hands. All right. William is home for the summer, and my wife loves jigsaw puzzles, and William and my wife dive into jigsaw puzzles. They pull out one of our tables, they buy, you know, one of those big boxes, they dump all the pieces on the table, and they get all excited, and they dive in. I personally could care less for jigsaw puzzles, right? They annoy me, in part because I don't like things I'm bad at. I'll just be honest, right? It's why I don't like baseball, okay? I'll watch it, but I just don't like to play it. All that to say, but you know, you want to participate with family. And so when they're into jigsaw puzzles this summer, what will I do? I'll try to join them. And it's rather maddening because I'm sitting there and I pull out one piece and I don't really want to be doing it. But if I can't find a home for this piece, the competitive side of me comes out and I won't stop until I can find the home. And the only thing more maddening about not being able to find a home for the piece is watching William and Aaron gleefully fill out like half the board while I'm trying to find the one piece, right? But what's the key thing if you're actually going to be able to put a jigsaw puzzle together? What do you have to have?
A board, the big picture.
Yeah, a board or self. Well, yeah, you got to have the big picture, right? If you got 1,000 pieces, but you have no idea what picture they're supposed to form, then, I mean, unless you're like the accountant, right? The slightly autistic guy who flips the pieces upside down and figures it all out. Like, that's not most of us. So, total side note. All that to say, you need the picture, right? We need the picture to fill it out. Think as well of the human body, right? What do we need as humans? Well, we need a skeletal structure. We have some 206 odd bones in our body. And those bones, that skeletal structure, well, that supports the rest of us. It gives shape to our body. And so just as every human body has a skeletal structure, so every text is going to have its own divinely inspired structure. And that structure provides the emphasis. It helps us know what to focus on, where to push our ideas and our thoughts. And so we want to think about this idea of structure this morning. So this really comes right here. Structure is this one of these practices. It's one of the tools that we use to do our exegesis. Just as a human body or a building, again, has an underlying structure, so every text has one too. So here is our principle for this. Here's the principle for structure. Every text has a structure. And the structure reveals the emphasis. And the emphasis must shape our message. Okay, so every text has a structure. The structure reveals the emphasis, and that emphasis ought to shape our message. So some of you will know Mortimer Adler. He, you know, famously spoke about how every book has a skeleton between its covers, and you can't apprehend the book unless you know the parts and how all the parts are meant to work together. So structure, this is important, structure is not just in the eye of the beholder. Structure is not something we impose upon the text. Structure is something the author, inspired by the Spirit, has actually put into the text and designed the text that way. And thus, we need to discover the structure, and we need to read the structure out of the text. Again, not impose it upon the text. So I think when it comes to structure, there are a number of dangers, at least two, that we want to avoid. And the first is this. Does anyone know what this is? It's not a spaceship. It's a jellyfish. Yeah. Don't you like my drawings? That's a jellyfish. What's notable about jellyfish? What do they not have? Yeah, they don't have a skeletal structure. Yeah, they don't have one. So they merely, if you've ever been in the ocean, right, they take all sorts of shapes and forms, and they just move along, and they're pushed with the currents. And I bring this up because some people are jellyfish preachers in the sense that there's no overriding structure to the message, right? They just sort of feel pulled and directed by whatever whim of the text struck them, whatever interesting idea, whatever thing they heard in the news. They let that be the defining characteristic. They let that provide the structure. And in that sense, there's no clear or organizing principle to what they have to say. And so if someone ever asks you, what is the sermon about? And you start just talking about this really fun detail in the text. Well, that's revealing that, okay, that might be a really fun detail, but the sermon should be about something the structure is revealing. So when they say, what's it about? You want to be able to give them something of the structure and explain what it's about, lest you become a jellyfish preacher, right? Okay, so we don't want that. But let's do this. So what is this guy? A crab. Yeah, it's a crab. There it is. What's significant about crabs? Yeah, they're like all skeleton, right? They're pretty much all exoskeleton. If you've ever tried to eat a small crab, which I have done because they're cheaper than the large crabs, if you ever go get, you know, fresh crab, you can do it. You can buy the cheap ones, and you can discover there's precious little meat in them. Okay, it is all skeleton. Just tell you now, if you go to Baltimore and you buy crabs, just buy the big ones because it'll be worth your while. But yeah, it's all exoskeleton. All you can see is the structure. And so if one risk is that we don't have any structure to our text and we're like jellyfish preachers, the other risk is that all we do is preach the structure. We don't put any flesh on it. We don't put any meat on it. There's no bones to the message. And so we don't want to do that either. That's another risk to avoid. So if you're going to be a faithful Bible teacher, you got to understand something about structure. And so in my own preparation, ideally, I start that preparation 1 or 2 hours on Wednesday morning. And the first thing I do is try to, well, if I'm able, I'll translate the text, right, depending how long it is. And then the first thing I'm looking at is structure. It's why on those worksheets, the first question is, how is the text organized, right? Do you discern any clear structure? And the temptation, though, is always to read it and to ask, like, what's the big idea? What's the thing that I get excited about? What's the thing I really want to preach? You know, what's that thing that might sing in the sermon, so to speak? That's the temptation, and we do that. And we'll jump, if we're not careful, right? We'll jump from text to today, right? We'll do that, and we'll skip the step if we're not careful. And the big idea, though, right, the big idea, what you're going to argue from your text, that is always a consequence of the structure. That's the thing you have to keep in mind. You have to remember the big idea, the main argument, right, what you're trying to persuade the people of in a sermon, because a sermon is not just giving information. A sermon is persuasion. We'll think about that later. Okay, where do we get that big idea? Well, it comes out of the structure. The structure should push us in that direction. Without structure, your sermons are only going to be as good as your own intuition. And some of you are more unconsciously competent than you may recognize, but most of us aren't. Most of us, if we just rely on our own intuition, we're going to get ourselves in trouble, right? Our frameworks will start to inform what we preach, etc. Okay, so again, long way round to safest way home. So three keys to helping discern structure. All right, three keys to helping discern structure. The first thing you want to think about is, so I'll write this here, is text type. So what do I mean? Well, you need to know something of the kind of literature that you're reading. So what kind of literature do we find in the Bible? Find narrative. Okay, so we find narrative. That's right. Can you give me an example?
Kings.
Kings, yeah. Genesis. First, Second Kings. Genesis has narratives. Samuel. John 18, right? We're out of Jesus' prayer, and we're actually into the final hours of his life. We're into narrative, right? So there's narrative. What's another text type?
Poetry.
Okay, good. Poetry. What would be an example of poetry?
Psalms.
Psalms, right? So we have a hymn book in the Bible. It's the Psalter, right? The Psalms. So, yeah. What would be another example of sort of poetic literature?
Song of Solomon.
Songs of Solomon. Yep, that would be another example. Yeah, Songs of Solomon. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. So narrative is sort of your storytellers. You can think of poetry as your songwriters. What's another form we have?
Apocalyptic.
Yeah, apocalyptic. And that's, yeah, you can think of that as its own. In some ways, it has elements of poetry in this last one. So I'm going to put that one in parentheses. But yeah, it is its own kind of animal. If you've read the second half of Daniel or Revelation, you know what I mean. Yeah, what's another?
Epistle.
Yeah, an epistle. What we might just call discourse. Okay, discourse. So these would be your letter writers. Or your speech writers. What would be some examples of that? 2 Timothy, there we go. Thank you. State the obvious. 2 Timothy is a good example of that. Okay. So these would be more carefully constructed arguments. And basically, that's it for the kinds of literature you're going to find in the Bible. And sometimes your text might have elements of more than one. So, for example, in John, you know, when we've been going through John, there are times where Jesus, you know, he feeds the 5,000, for example, and then he teaches on what the feeding means. And if you're looking at the whole chapter, you've got narrative and discourse. And so you have to take it together. So the first key is to know the text type. The second is to recognize different types organize structure differently, which I think is intuitive to you all, but just worth noting. So how many of you have ever read like a Supreme Court brief or like some kind of legal document? Okay, a few of you. You get the idea. If you've ever heard them discussed, right? A Supreme Court brief will read quite differently from a love letter. Yeah, I hope your love letters don't read like Supreme Court briefs, right? I hope they don't read like an encyclopedia. Okay, so different types of literature communicate and structure differently. So if we think back to sort of poetry here, poetry is going to use evocative language, lots of imagery. So thinking of Songs of Solomon, we read in 7:4, your nose is like a tower of Lebanon which looks toward Damascus. Now, I don't encourage you to use that one tonight, all right? You can give it a shot. I don't think Aaron would appreciate that as much as the woman in Songs of Solomon would. But we can agree that the language he's using, it's evocative language, right? There's lots of imagery. He's meant to be drawing things to mind. And if you read Songs of Solomon, there is some pretty graphic, direct stuff in there that is meant to call to mind the joy of intimacy, the longing of intimacy and of being together. That reads very different, again, to a Supreme Court brief. So different types will structure themselves and organize themselves differently. And then thirdly, there's no substitute in discerning structure. There's no substitute for doing what? Any ideas? What's a key thing that you want to do if you're going to try to understand structure? Read it over and over. That's right. Yeah, I'm not trying to complicate this, guys. Read and reread and do that over and over and over again. So when I preached through Job here years ago, that book frightened me and I didn't know how to do it. And so I spent one morning and I read through it 4 times. Well, I assure you, reading through it 4 times did more to help me understand that book and understand the logical flow and the structure of the book than anything else I could have done. Commentaries do not help with this. I hate to say that. You can look in the table of contents and they might give you some rough breakdowns. The Gospel of John is broken up into 2 books, right? And we can see that much. So you have the first 3 years of Jesus's life, basically the first 12 chapters. And then in the next chapters, 13 to 20, you get the last 3 days, right? It's broken up like that. We'll see that again this morning. Okay, that much is clear. But within that, commentaries really don't help you with structure. What's going to help you is to read, reread, and reread. And sometimes that will mean reading different translations. I'd encourage you to do that. Because where our translations put in section breaks and headers, that's not inspired. That's what the editors of the translation do. So there are times when the ESV will break a section in a way that I think is awkward. We saw this in the first week with 2 Timothy. So the natural break is at the end of verse 5, 2 Timothy 1. But they lump, you know, verses 6 and following into that first section. I think they should have broken it up. Other translations break it up after verse 5. All that to say, right, reading and rereading and reading other translations will start to help you see some of these things. Yeah, question.
What are like your most commonly read other translations other than the ESV?
So,
Message.
You know, so I don't, no, that's fine. It's worthwhile. So the Message isn't a translation, I would say it. Message is a paraphrase. That being said, so the New Living Translation is actually, that is a translation. And it's more on the, what you call sort of functional equivalent side. All that to say, I will read, it's really helpful if you know original languages, if you're going to teach the Bible all the time. Now, you don't need to know original languages to teach the Bible well. There are some wonderful pastors out there that never knew the original languages and they can preach faithfully. It might take a little more work, but I'll always read the ESV, the CSB, the NIV 84, and the NIV 11. I'll read the NET, the NASB, and the New Living. And actually, in my Bible software, I have all of them up. And so when I'm working through the text, I'm working verse by verse, and I'm seeing, okay, I translated it. This is what the ESV did. And sometimes if I'm careless in my translation, it's when I look at how someone else translated something, I realize, oh, I missed something. There's a big question of what to do with this. right? But those are all the translations I read. You don't need to read all of them, but it is helpful to read things that are a little bit more in the what we call like dynamic equivalent or functional equivalent. So it's not quite the wooden word for word. So the NASB is sort of over here on the sort of wooden word for word, and there's the ESV. Then you get the CSB and the NIV kind of in the middle, and then you start going toward New Living and others. And I think it's helpful to read a little bit on this spectrum and that spectrum, right? So that's a great question. Okay. So again, you want to read and reread the text. So you're trying to understand the shape. You're trying to see sort of what's behind it all. And again, that's not always immediate apparent. So again, step one, you want to recognize the text type. Step two, recognize not all text types will organize in the same way. You want to read, read, reread. Okay, so now what strategies? We're doing that. We're reading. Now what strategies can we use to look for structure? So if we're in narrative, think back maybe to English or theater class. What's a common strategy maybe your English teacher taught you to understand how narratives work? Does this look at all familiar to people? What's that? It's a bad drawing of what? Anyone know? Yeah, it's a plot arc. So you have the setting, then you have some kind of conflict, you have rising action, then you hit sort of the climax, and then you have the denouement, or well, however, you don't, you have to use a French word. What's the other word for that? Yeah, the resolution. Thank you. Conclusion. Thanks, Nick. Yeah, it's good to have you. And then back to stasis, right? To the sort of this a new setting, right? So you got a plot arc. I know that's messy. You can make the sense of it. And typically in a plot arc, where would the emphasis be? Yeah, it's somewhere right around here. It's at that point where the story, you can't go backward. Once you've hit this point, you can never go backward. You're always going to land somewhere else. And so if you preach your text and you never get, you don't highlight this at all, but you spend all the time talking about the conflict or over here, then that's what we call having the wrong emphasis. You follow me? Yeah, okay. Some of you get it. Okay. Yeah, so that's plot arc. You might arrange it around characters. So in John 18 this morning, plot arc. So I'm literally this week, I'm thinking about these strategies because I have a narrative. Plot arc did not help me in John 18, 1 to 27. So, you know, if you're, some of you work with tools, I'm awful with physical tools, but maybe you get the idea, right? You've got a problem and you can bring out this screwdriver, this wrench or whatever. And if it doesn't work to unlock the thing, you got to keep trying different tools. It's the same principle. Plot arc didn't help me. Ah, but then I got to characters and you're starting to see Judas. Well, then you're seeing the Pharisees, the high priest, the officers, you're seeing Peter, you're seeing a contrast to Jesus. Okay, and you're all of a sudden things start to come alive a little bit, right? So you can get characters. You can look at other literary features. What might be some literary features?
Repetition.
Yeah, repetition. There's scene changes. So 18:1 starts like when Jesus had finished saying these things, like they went out by night, right? There's obviously a big scene change there. Geographic markers, temporal markers, sometimes bookends, right? You see that. So those are all things in narrative. Now, when we get to poetry, I'm just going to give you a few. We're not in poetry, so I'm not going to take the time. But the big one you're looking for is imagery. So obviously a lot, you think of vine language, you know, in the poetic books and in the prophets, there's lots of vine language that becomes evocative. If you know Hosea, what's the evocative image in Hosea? Whoredom. Yeah, exactly. In Psalms, you often have parallelism where the start of a line introduces the idea and the second line sort of develops it or qualifies it. So you have that. Now, when we're dealing with discourse, which is where we are, dealing with discourse, what are we looking for here with discourse, with this kind of literature? What things should we be looking for to try to discern how the author has arranged the text?
Logic.
Yeah, so logic. And how do we see logic in discourse? Grammar. So this is your opportunity to make your fifth grade English teacher proud. Okay? Grammar always wins. Drill that in your head. Grammar always wins. So when we get to the Great Commission, right? Go therefore and make disciples, baptizing them in the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey all that I've commanded you, right? So when you think of that, what is the main verb in that command? Because we've got going and baptizing and teaching and making disciples. So how do we know which of those things to emphasize? Grammar tells you. There's one verb in the indicative. It's make disciples. Going, baptizing, and teaching are all participles that modify what it means to make disciples. So if you're looking at the text, you're like, I got these four verbal ideas. Which one do I focus on? Which one gets the emphasis? Well, if you make it all on going, you know, here I am, send me. I love Isaiah. I'm going to make it all about going. We need to go to the nations. Well, that's true, but you have your emphasis wrong, right? It's making disciples. That's the emphasis, and all the others modify how to do that. Grammar always wins. You've got to look at grammar, okay? And if you didn't have good grammar, guess what? You're going to get better at grammar studying the Bible, okay? I had no grammar, literally. I moved to Santa Cruz, and in Santa Cruz, they believed, because it's a crazy place, that grammar stifles freedom of thought. So I was taught no grammar. I got to college, I turned in my first paper, and I got it back without a grade. And the professor asked to see me. And he said, I didn't give you a grade on this. And I knew why. I had utterly failed. He's like, you have great ideas. You don't know how to write at all. And I had to go learn how to write. I had to learn grammar. You know what really helped me learn grammar? Learning Greek, right? Reading my Bible. Have to learn grammar. So there's hope for you if you didn't have any grammar, right? I didn't get any. All that to say, logic, grammar, that is really important. Bookends, like a top and tail, like ideas that are repeated. These are all things you want to be looking for, okay? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to spend a minute and do two examples. So I want you in your groups there, open, actually, what am I supposed to be done, 9:35? Okay, so turn to Acts 5, 1-11 in your group, and using some of the tools we've thought about, try to discern the structure. I'm trying to pick a text you can jump right into, Ananias and Sapphira, most of us know it, right? It's the Baptist preacher's favorite message when he wants to pick the giving up, right? He preaches Acts 5. I'm kidding. Okay, look at it and see if you can discern a structure. We'll come back in 2 minutes.
So,
All right, I'm going to cut us a little short. Okay, so some of you may feel like you've made great progress. Other people are like, I just read it, and I'm trying to get my head around it. That's okay. So Acts, like Gospels, can sometimes be a little tricky because you've got both narrative and discourse. So this is a story, but within the story, you have speech. But in the broader structure, it is a story. So be thinking more in the lines of narrative. And I'll pose this question. How many scenes do we have? What do you think?
Three.
Okay. What's the first scene? Okay, so like, so you're thinking verse 1 and 2? Mm-hmm. Is that what you're thinking?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, you might break verses 1 and 2 up, and maybe that's kind of a setting. You might also just lump it in with verses 1 to 4, depending. So like, let's think about it. And then if the next scene starts, it would sort of start in verse 3. And then think of it like that, and where does the third scene start? In 7. Okay. So verse 7. Okay. And so if verse 1 and 2 kind of set us up, right? It's setting us up for what's going to happen in 3 to 6 and then 7 to 11. Does that seem fair? Does that seem pretty
clear? Is that how you would have done it, or would you have been broken up into 2?
Well, we're going to get there. I actually don't think it matters a ton. Either way you do it, when you preach it, you're not going to probably preach verses 1 and 2 as a separate point. That's my guess. Because it's really just setting you up for what it's about to happen. So if I'm preaching it, I may read it and then use that for context and then jump into my points. But then, what do you really have in verses 3 and 4? You have a kind of conflict, don't you? Okay. And then what happens to Ananias as a consequence of this conflict, of him keeping back? What happens to him?
Yeah,
5 and 6, he dies. And then what's the consequence of that?
Fear.
Oh, that's interesting. So we get into verses 7 to 9. What do we have again? We have another conflict. So this one was with Ananias. This one was Sapphira. What happens to her?
She dies.
She dies. And what happens as a consequence of her death? More fear. Right? So what do you have? You basically have two parallel stories. They're functioning very similarly. And they're trying to really drive a point home. They're trying to push a point. Right? You are not, basically, you're not at liberty to toy with God. God's not to be played with, right? He is an awe-inspiring, fearful God. And you can think about it in the context of Acts, and you can think about it, like, the way it fits into the broader structure of the book. If you're preaching it, you'd want to do that. But just, you can see right now, you basically have two broad scenes right here. And so then the question would be, do you preach these as two separate scenes, or do you really preach the conflict, the death, and the fear is three separate points? That's the decision you make as the preacher, right? But you're already seeing how this structure is going to push you in a preaching direction. Does that make sense? Okay. Because you've got, it's the author has set it up with conflict, death, fear. Conflict, death, fear. And that's what you want to see. So Let me just walk you through one more in the interest of time, because I've been going 36 minutes according to this. Look to 2 Timothy 1:6 to 12. You looked at that last week. I'm intentionally picking a text, right? Didn't you look at that last week? Okay. So you may not have, well, you weren't thinking about structure a ton then. But in 1 to 5, Paul has basically said, Timothy, you've got the faith thing. You're the real deal, not like these false teachers. And so, as a consequence of that, he's going to say, fan into flame this gift. And then he's going to say, don't be ashamed. But suffer. He's going to say that. He's going to say suffer. And he's going to say that for the gospel. And then he's going to turn to Jesus. So this is all to Timothy. And it functions, it's kind of imperatival, right? Fan this into flame. Don't be ashamed. Suffer for the gospel. And gets to Jesus. But then notice as you keep reading, well, Paul talks about his suffering for the gospel. And so he's not ashamed. Do you see that? We're actually going in and working our way back out. I'm not ashamed, right? So we go from Timothy to Jesus to Paul. Do you guys see that? Some of the structure? I'm giving it to you really quickly, but you see it? So what do we, anyone know what we call this?
Chiasm.
It's a chiasm. Yeah, that's a chiasm. Now here's the thing. Do you need to see the chiasm to recognize this pattern? You don't need to know the word chiasm. You just need to recognize that there's a kind of movement from Paul, from Timothy to Jesus to Paul. And at the center of it is all of the work of Christ. It's the gospel. So Paul's not saying, Timothy, man up, solus bootstrapsis, right? Just dig in hard. He's saying, look to the gospel for your strength and for your ability to persevere, right? The gospel is the strength. The gospel is the hope. And he turns to himself as an example. So if you're preaching this text, you're going to want to give a lot of attention to the motivation that the gospel brings, not just a self-effort. Does that make sense? Okay, so I did that really quickly just so you could see it, and because of time and because you looked at it last week. And maybe, right, that helps you better understand the text last week. So as I close, you want to be faithful Bible teachers, all right? So know the text types, know different strategies, think about them, because every text has a structure. The structure reveals the emphasis, right? Don't go after the emphasis, go after the emphasis. And the emphasis must shape our message. Last thing I'll say, for your worksheet this week, I will give you a heads up. The structure is a little trickier in your text today. I looked at it, I'm like, that's kind of unfortunate, but that's okay, right? Sometimes structure is a little tricky to get at. You do the best you can with it. Look at grammar. I'm just giving you a heads up. As we go through it, and as we have some more of these, I'll be able to highlight how structure will really be able to help, okay? All right, let me pray for us, and then I'm going to let you guys to your small groups. God, we pray, help us to be faithful stewards of your word. Help us to be those who read it, who don't impose structure upon the text, but can see it and therefore better understand what you're trying to communicate to us. Amen.